sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed decides to do nothing for now. The Bank of Japan tweaks their stimulus plans. Twitter surges on takeover speculation. And we're going to be focusing on listener questions and some answers. All this and much more on episode number 477 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good day to you. Thanks for listening in. Andrew Horowitz here. And it is the last week of September. Lots happened in the last few weeks with regard to speculation on what the Fed was going to do or what they're not going to do, what's happening with the Bank of Japan and Europe, all the central banks, as well as what is going to be the most appropriate valuation for markets. We did see that Janet Yellen came out with a rate decision from the Fed, and they decided not to do anything, just keep it as it is right now. It wasn't necessarily because, as she said, she's concerned about the economy. It was, in fact, a good economy outlook that she said, although, interestingly enough, while she said that things were good, they marked down the actual GDP outlook for the next several quarters, which kind of is interesting because if on one hand things are good, but yet they marked it down, you have to wonder what's exactly going on there. But they did hold the rate at the level that it is, stating that while there was sufficient evidence that the economy was on track and employment was on track and inflation was getting closer to their level that they felt would be appropriate, but not quite there, and there was a little bit excess labor slack still in the markets, so they're going to keep it on hold. But they may, in fact, consider, because they think they're going to raise it again at least once in 2016. Now, if you remember, I talked about this game plan that I thought they were going to follow because it seemed to work very well for them last year. And simply that was that they were going to follow along with the idea that, well, let's hint around and set the stage into September that we'll have a rate hike, not do it, and then come along in December and hike rates at the end of the year. They still mention that each and every meeting they have now through the end of the year will be a, quote, live meeting, meaning they could actually increase, but we'll see what happens with that. Bottom line is that they did have a 7-3 vote in favor of holding rates. It was a very tight margin there. Usually you don't see that many dissenters in these, and it was kind of interesting, and people looked at this as a question of what that meant. But again, the markets seem to enjoy the fact that rates were going to stay lower for a longer period of time, at least for the next 2 months, and rallied on the actual information that was presented. So the consensus again is that at the end of the year or by the end of the year, there'll be another rate hike, but it could be a lot of smoke being blown and a lot of just prepping the markets for some time in the future, trying to keep the reins wielded in a little bit there. We saw some information out of the Bank of Japan as well. They actually did nothing except for target their 10-year yield, keeping it at what they say is at a zero rate. So in the past, they would be buying bonds and they would be potentially moving rates lower into the more negative range. But now what they're doing is they decided that something they haven't done in decades is targeting the 10-year yield, keeping it at zero. So what that actually means is that even if markets start to sell off the bonds because maybe the economics are getting better, maybe there's a lack of support for the Bank of Japan's stimulus actions or whatever the reason may be, that sellers step in and say, you know what, yields should be higher right now. The Bank of Japan is just going to be chopping their heads off one by one and buying every bond that is out there to keep the rate pinned at 0%. And what that also means is that if we know now that the Bank of Japan will be keeping rates at zero, why not just go in and sell those bonds, take the money, and then buy something else somewhere else, maybe a bond in the U.S., maybe some stocks in anywhere around the world, because really what you have is the implicit guarantee at this point that the Bank of Japan will buy any of these bonds and not allow them to move. Therefore, the risk that you would have necessarily when you would actually go in and buy or sell a bond is no longer there because they're keeping the levels at a certain level pinned at 0%. So that can be another reason why we saw some stocks moving up. There is the idea that the arbitrage deal is back on. Now, a couple of things before we get to the listener questions that we have. And by the way, you can always ask me a question by going to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And there's a little button at the top there, a little area in the navigation bar at the top of the site that says Ask Andrew, and just put your question. Ask me what you want. See if we can get it on the show. Let's talk a little bit about some of the information that we also saw last week with regard to the housing markets. We saw that a slight dip in existing home sales, but we also saw that there was a lot of home builder confidence. The numbers that we saw over the last few weeks that came out on the NAHB were that home builders are pretty much in great shape. They had a very good outlook in terms of new homes that were being built. So this number on the housing sales for existing homes, not the biggest deal in the world. But we saw that housing starts also fell about almost 6% last month, and building permits decreased about 0.4%, almost a half percent, which followed a 0.8% drop in July. So we're going to watch the housing market. It's possible that the low interest rates and the continuation of this will be something that helps to move them in a better way, or maybe the fact that there was a little bit of a tick higher for rates last month with the speculation that the Fed was going to possibly raise rates in September, even though that was only a 20% chance. Maybe some people laid off a little bit and decided to hold off. There could be a lot of different reasons. Now, oil was really the kind of the wild mover for the week. We saw that there was comments at the beginning of the week from Venezuela that said, oh yeah, there's going to be some kind of an agreement reached or whatever. And I wondered right off the bat when I heard this news that who's believing any of the commentary out of Venezuela? Their government is so corrupt and so upside down and doing such a poor job right now. You gotta take that with a grain of salt, because really the next day what you saw was pretty much a reversal of their comments and them whining about the excess supply and the concerns about that. And oil turned around on that as well on the way down. By the end of the week, where there was a lot of speculation that there will be some kind of a deal cut maybe by Russia that alongside of OPEC and non-OPEC to freeze production, drop production, or something that they were going to do over this weekend, by Friday, a lot of the anticipation and the excitement of that just dissipated entirely. And oil fell about 4% on Friday. Finished up at 44.5 for the week. So there was still a 2% gain for the week, by the way, with all the speculation that was going on. But I guess a lot of traders ahead of any kind of weekend news said, you know what? I don't want any part of this. I don't want anything to do with it. Stocks did end up for the week higher. Saw that the NASDAQ was up about 1.2%. Dow was up about 0.75%. And the S&P was up a little over 1% for the week. Now, what's interesting is that the trade back to those places that afford a great level of yield, like utilities and REITs. You know, utilities are up to over 20% year to date. Utilities, boring utilities. And that's all about the yield. That search for yield is ongoing and very strong. Let's talk about, just for a moment, what's happening next week. We're going to see new homes sales. That's going to be happening for August on Monday. And some earnings out there. There's still some things trickling in. We have Carnival, Thor Industries. But Monday night is the big presidential debate that I think a lot of people are going to be looking at right now. It looks like a pretty close race, generally speaking. And we'll see how things go, if there's going to be fireworks and name-calling and fingers pointed and just some really harsh words, or if it's going to be a little bit more of a calmer, more presidential-like debate. I don't, not holding my breath for that. We have the Consumer Confidence Index for September coming out, and the July Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And then Fed Chair Yellen's going to be testifying on bank supervision and regulation before the House Financial Services Committee, which will be very interesting. I'm sure Wells Fargo will be discussed at length during that conversation. Durable goods are coming out. Some other things like earnings from Paychex, Pier 1. And Thursday, there's another Kansas City Fed conference, which Janet Yellen will be speaking at. And then some other earnings at the end of the week from Conagra Foods, Costco, Pepsi. So University of Michigan also on Friday will be coming out. So we have a pretty reasonably packed week with economic news to end the month of September. And we have a lot more Fed speaking, which you got to just put in as the given these days, because the Fed speakers just seem to talk about any possible thing they can talk about on a regular basis. But the Wells Fargo thing is definitely heating up. There's no question about that. And we'll see how that plays out. We talked about that a lot on the Tuesday night DH Unplugged last week. I don't know how that's going to play out, but there's a lot of lawsuits that are coming in right now. And it's a real black eye for the banking industry. And I wonder if, in fact, it is isolated just to Wells Fargo. Most times, it's not just one player that does these kinds of things. So we're going to look at that as well. We're going to talk about some of the listener questions. And then when we get back, we'll talk about a little bit about Twitter just for a moment. So I've been telling you that we have an area on the disciplinedinvestor.com where you can actually go and simply ask me a question. Instead of sending me an email, which you could always do too, but I thought it would be interesting and better to have them a little bit more consolidated. So you go to the disciplinedinvestor.com and you can go to the top where it says Ask Andrew, and then just send me a question about whatever it is regarding finance or markets or your portfolio, whatever it may be. Anyway, so we did get a good list of people that had asked some questions. It was interesting because a lot of questions came in about the Fed and central banks. Now, I know that's been a topic of discussion for some time that we've had here, but I was kind of interested that there's so many people asking about the central bank and kind of wondering what's so hard about what they're doing and making a decision. But nonetheless, let's get to some of these questions with regard to that and other things. So the first question comes in from Aaron, and he does ask, why is everyone so concerned about a quarter point move by the Fed? It seems like it would be insignificant. And then he asked me about thoughts on REITs, high dividends that they pay are really good, but aren't they kind of expensive right now? So let's talk about the first thing. You know, about the Fed, one of the things we've been talking about is why are they agonizing? Why are they having such a problem with this, small amount? This week they came out with no move. They said, well, yeah, we're ripe for a move and things are getting better and possibly we'll have a move soon, but we're not doing it right now. They're concerned about the economy and the job slack and some other things. They're not at their inflation target. But what's the big concern? We're talking about moving a quarter point right now in an economy that pretty much is at full employment by most measures, moving along pretty well. Earnings are good by companies. The housing numbers are good. The problem is that they're very concerned about what reaction that will have on not only the stock markets, the dollar, but also the bond markets. Now, a rise in interest rates does translate to a rise in the value of the dollar. That's not good for the rest of the world. Even though it's a quarter point move, The question is going to be, well, how many more moves are they going to make? And where is this going to eventually end up? Where are the Fed funds going to be in a year from now? And oftentimes markets will try to handicap that and move towards that number. And as such, the dollar could move up. And again, that's really not good for trade here as well as many other areas around the world. The other thing is that they have about a $5 trillion book of bonds that they're holding on their balance sheet. And if you had the ability to actually have a switch that if you put it up, stocks will go up and that's good for your portfolio. Or if you put it down, well, it's not going to be good. Things are going to sell off and it's going to be bad for your portfolio. Well, basically the switch they have, if they keep it to a degree up and they don't increase and they keep interest rates low, their bond portfolio will be just fine. However, even though they're holding it to maturity for the most part for these, you can see a big dip in the value there and maybe they don't want to do that. In addition, it costs more to issue the bonds. And if they're going to be actually continuing buying bonds as it is, the government will have to pay more on the bonds that they issue for the Fed to buy. So there's a lot of things, you know, listen, most of it's kind of nuance here, but there's a lot of things that go into their decision. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think they're being way too conservative. And I think that the economy can handle it. The markets can handle it, you know, at least after an initial shock. Now, REITs fall right into this discussion too, Aaron, because REITs are high-paying real estate investments. The income flows through. There's been a lot of discussion about you know, how great that it is that we can get a much better interest rate on things like stocks and REITs and a variety of places rather than CDs and money markets, bonds. So let's invest there. Yes, their valuations are definitely high. They've come down recently. But you know what? As the chase for yield continues and as we see that interest rates are low, this is just going to continue for some time. Until such a time that interest rates are at a point where, let's say that you can get, I'll just throw a number out, 2% on a bank account, 2% on a money market, or even a short-term bond, you can get a decent rate. All these alternatives are going to see a flock of people moving towards them. All right, next question. Comes in from Robert, Robert W. He asks, or he says, I've heard options are a better way to trade in the market with less money. What are some tips and strategies one should do? Any books I should read and look into as well? Thanks. Well, I don't know if you heard this, Robert, but yes, clearly options are a way to lever the use of money in order to buy and bet on the outcome of a stock, whether it's going to be higher or lower. Now, something I always say about this is that when you look at the options and you look at what is entailed and involved in it, clearly you have to be right in two ways. You have to be right in time and you have to be right in price. You have to get to the right place and you have to do it in a certain amount of time. So realize that that's something that's very important. Now, with that said, yes, to answer your question, there is a variety of strategies when using options. You could just buy a put, sell a put, buy a call, sell a call, do straddles, strangles, condors, a variety of different things that you want to learn. Now, we did have a wonderful guest recently on episode number 473. His name is Kirk Duplessis. What I want you to do is go over to optionalpha.com. He has a really wonderful training process using options. And I think a lot of it's free. You can sign up for some of his premium content, but he has tons of videos out and he shows you exactly how to trade and work with options in order to try to enhance returns and explains a lot of the setups, a lot of the key features, ways in which to profit with a little money out of pocket net when you do these various paired trades with options. So that's something you could take a look at. And the other thing that you can look at is in episode number 474, these are all very recent, by the way, Carly Garner has a book called High Probability Commodity Trading, where she talks about also using various futures in the markets. Now, futures also are a way to use less, quote unquote, less money to leverage up. By the way, all these different kinds of things that you use, quote unquote, less money to trade are usually involved with some kind of leverage. So you're buying something at a lower cost. However, the actual amount of capital that you're controlling in the form of a stock or commodity is a lot higher. So the movements and the money that can be made or lost is much more accentuated. Just keep that in mind when we're talking about these kinds of instruments. So Kirk Duplessis, optionalpha.com. And listen to episode number 473. And Carly Garner, High Probability Commodity Trading. She has a book out. That's episode number 474. All right, next. Daniel C. says, why wouldn't the Fed reduce its balance sheet before raising rates? Wouldn't that action have a similar reaction with respect to increasing money market rates? Thanks for your podcast. Great. Thanks, Daniel, for writing in. Let me talk about a couple things here. Excellent point. However, if the Fed actually reduces its balance sheet, and how would they do that? The $5 trillion of bonds, the first thing they could do is stop the reinvestment of interest and the reinvestment of maturing debt. Because right now what's happened is every time there's an interest payment or there's a reinvestment that comes through from the proceeds from maturing bonds that they held, well, what they do is they just buy more bonds. So if they stop that, let's say they just stop that and didn't do anything else. They didn't reduce anything down. Otherwise, they didn't sell anything off. All they did was stop the purchases of bonds from these various mechanisms through their quantitative easing program. Well, what would that do? Well, the first thing it would do is create less of a market and take out a lot of liquidity from the markets, because now the major player in the treasury market is no longer there. So what would happen? Well, potentially without that liquidity, without that backstop of that buyer, you could see rates really rising because a lot of other people would back away as well. Because now that you don't have the Fed doing all that buying, some of the players that have been betting on bonds so dramatically for some time, because you have this monster that is, you know, basically investing the same way you will, is no longer there. So maybe they'd back off too. Now, what would happen? Well, we don't know exactly. But probably what would happen is that rates would start moving around much more dramatically, because now, again, you don't have anybody pegging that rate necessarily or putting that rate at the level that they want it, because they could just buy as much as they want, or they're involved in buying a tremendous amount, as opposed to a rate hike, which is a much more controlled move. With a rate hike, they know, okay, it's going to be 0.25%. That's what we're willing to deal with. Fine. And it doesn't really hit necessarily the entire spectrum of the bonds. However, it's a much more controlling maneuver than actually stopping the purchases or reducing their balance sheet. Now, another thing that they could do is something called reverse repos. Now, this is where the central bank basically does a collateralized loan and borrows money from the primary dealers or the banks. Look at them as the banks. Now, that has the effect of sucking money out of the economy, because there's less money that is going to be lent out. There's less money that the banks have. They're getting closer to their appropriate levels of money that's overall allowed to be loaned out, as well as the fact that, you know, they have to be careful with their deposits and their loan books and kind of keeping those in check. So what they could do is reverse repos. And what the reverse repos will do is actually have the effect of slowing down the economy, or at least slowing down lending. I don't think they want to do that. They can do that, though. They have the ability to do that. So there's a lot of other mechanisms also that the central banks have. But I think that right now they are such a dramatically large buyer of treasuries, even simply with just the interest payments and the maturity money going back in, that if they stopped doing that, I think there would be possibly a much greater move in the bond market than they're really desiring to do. And again, they're all about controlling interest rates, as that's really the only thing that they can do. So what that's going to mean is it's going to get away from them. All right, now, Paul. And by the way, I'll mention again, if you have any questions, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click the button on the top of the navigation bar that says Ask Andrew. Very simple. And you can ask me a question on anything you have, and we'll get it on the air in the future, or I'll answer you directly. I make sure to answer either everybody directly if it's a little bit more personal, or put it on the air so everybody can get some of the educational value out of what we're talking about. This is an interesting question. This came from Paul L. And he asks, he says, Andrew, listen, my question is about volatility and liquidity in the futures markets. The ES, or the S&P futures, is a very liquid and generally is not volatile. On the other hand, crude futures is less liquid and more volatile than the ES, and it has bigger moves. So during the summer months or Christmas week, for example, when the liquidity of the S&P 500 futures becomes lower, why does it become even less volatile? I would have thought that it would behave more like less liquid and more volatile instruments like crude or gold or the DAX or some other areas. Now, let's kind of talk about for a moment. I don't know if this necessarily happens all the time, but okay, I'll go with the fact that there's definitely less volatility in certain times of the year when we see like holidays and things like that. But the question really is, why don't we see that much more wider of moves like we see with, for example, things like gold or maybe even crude oil? I think it's a function of why there is less volatility is because there's less people trading it. So where you have a less liquid instrument and a good amount of people trading it, you may have a lot of volatility, moves up and down because you're getting people pushing in and pushing out. However, during Christmas or some holidays, during the summer months in certain ways, there's a lot less people trading. That's why the volatility is less, because the volume is that much lower on still what is a liquid instrument. So I think the comparison between the two is not exactly the same. I think it has to do, again, more of a function of lower volume, and that's why you have lower liquidity. And even though the crude has lower volume, if you will, there's a lot more people trading it on a regular basis in terms of the ratio. That's why you do see those spikes, et cetera. And there's moves that are dramatic. So again, I think it's a relative discussion there. But I think overall, that was a very good question, actually. It made me think a bit. I had to really kind of consider, yeah, that does make sense. Why is that? All right, this next question, the last question comes from Tom W. And he says, Andrew, listen, do you have an opinion on the financial disaster as described by Porter Stansberry or Chris Martinson, etc.? I'd be interested if you bought into that. And if so, what steps should investors take to protect themselves? Let me just say this, that yes. Is there a financial disaster in the future? Yeah. When? Why? To what area? What would cause it? I don't know if I can actually come up with a particular reason. Could I say that the amount of debt that's outstanding and the central bank activities, the margin outstanding, the amount of speculation that's in the markets right now, the buybacks that are keeping things afloat are all part of that? Yeah. The fact that, you know, we still haven't fixed the banking sector in Europe and that could be a problem. China's, you know, all sorts of problems with their debt loads and problems there. Japan is just never-ending issues. All those things could lead to a financial disaster. However, there are still a lot of ways to fix many of those things, first of all. And second of all, I think, again, without naming names, that some of the marketing that is done with regard to this impending financial disaster that was supposed to arrive 4 years ago, then 3 years ago, and 2 years ago, eventually, like anything else, even a broken clock will be right twice a day. However, if you're constantly planning for a disaster, how far is that going to get you? And I think that the idea that I heard many years ago is that, well, bad news sells. Good news doesn't sell. Or you got to disturb people in order to get them to do something. You know what? There's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. What I mean by that is, you know, or maybe it was last week, the week before, we talked about my very big concern about fixed income. Okay, well, that's one sector, one area. We didn't talk about a total meltdown. We just said that, you know what, things are getting a little bit wacky here and you got to be really careful about which particular area. Not like get out of bonds entirely, not like, you know, run for the hills and, you know, just hedge out totally on this or just pull all your money out and put it under the mattress. No, just you need to change your portfolio a little bit and you need to make some adjustments. The sky isn't falling. And I think when you see these kind of hit jobs on a video, which, oh, the end of the world is coming, how to protect yourself, I think there's a lot more marketing in there than there is actual substance. Not all of them. And I do believe many of them have done a good amount of research to come up with their opinions. I don't think they're lying. I think this is their opinion. However, it also brings out, as you know, within all of us as humans, our concern factor. Listen, you don't go to the dentist if everything's just fine. Usually maybe you go twice a year for a checkup, but you know what? In between them, you know, like, you know what? I was thinking, I'm going to the dentist. I have a few hours to kill this afternoon. I'm going to go to the dentist. No, you wait till, man, I got a toothache. And I think what's happening here is that they're creating a toothache. They're telling you that, you know what? If you don't go today, if you don't do something about this now, your teeth can fall out. Now, you may want to believe that or not, but maybe some of us are more prone to believing some of that. And not only believing it, but just simply saying, well, you know, if that's the case, I'm going to do something about it. Whereas maybe the right thing to do is every 6 months or maybe 3 months, go to the dentist on a regular basis. If something does occur, great. But you know what? To pound you over the head all the time about that the markets are going to crash, the financial disaster is going to happen, basically going to be in a financial apocalypse. I think that maybe it's more for selling their goods and their wares rather than anything else. That's just my opinion. Now, I'm not, you mentioned the names here, Tom. I didn't. Porter Stansberry, Chris Mann. I'm not talking about them. I'm just talking about the concept of how to understand things. Like, for example, let's go to the other side. How about all those people that are talking these bullish discussions on various TV shows? And you have to wonder, why are they doing that? Well, some of them are doing it because simply they have a book of business or they own a stock. You know, on Twitter, you see this all the time. Somebody's commenting about some rinky-dink stock and every piece of news that comes out, oh, look how great this is. Meanwhile, the stock has been stuck in a zero zone forever. But you know what? This thing is going to be the next thing. Why do they say that? They want to bring you into it and bring up investor opinion of it, and they want you to buy it, and therefore their shares go up. So you have to look at, I think, both sides, a little bit of reality. Many of us focus on the negative more than the positive. It's a lot more, it's easier to deal with, I think, in some degree of, you know what, fine, it's all good and all that, but you know what, I want to be prepared. Being prepared is a good thing. And yes, I do agree that you need to be aware of the situation. However, I don't think necessarily you put all your money in gold, all your money in silver, short the market 100% all the time, because, you know, you need to be diversified. You need to have a bit of everything because you know what? What if their situation doesn't play out? Middle of the road, objective, not so one-sided. It's probably the better way to be involved in markets and to be trading and to be investing than to be in a situation where you're leaning one way entirely or the other way entirely. So I guess the example that I would bring up as in naming somebody is Jeremy Siegel, who you see on CNBC. Is a Wharton, professor. But I also think he has a big piece of a ETF family called Wisdom Tree. I think he's one of the founders or something of that. He's involved in them at least. You would think that Wisdom Tree probably benefits from all of his optimism. I don't ever recall him being bearish. As a matter of fact, I remember him saying not too long ago, when markets came down, I think it was the beginning of this year and the end of last year, he said something like, well, you know, with all my, I didn't see that correction coming. Well, aren't you paid to see this? Or are you just paid to say that things will get better and be the eternal optimist and simply just always talk up the markets? Because if you don't see both sides in terms of if you're a professor and you're professing that you know all about this, you know, what's going on and you study these markets, and that's what you're coming on CNBC or Bloomberg or Fox or whatever you're coming on to talk up the markets, don't you think you should have an opportunity to say, you know, maybe things are going to fall down here and I see something on the horizon that doesn't look so good, as opposed to being an eternal bear. Listen, he wrote a book called Stocks for the Long Run back a number of years ago, and he was talking about some crazy numbers on the Dow at that point. And he missed the 2008-2009 correction entirely. So just keep that in mind. When something becomes so one-sided, you have to question whether or not there's an ulterior motive for it. And I'm always the skeptic, so I'm going to kind of look for that and just kind of flush it out as best as I can. But great question, Tom. I really appreciate it. Like I said, if you do want to ask any questions, you can do so. And if, as a matter of fact, I'll mention at this time, I haven't mentioned this in probably years. Stupid of me. But, you know, The Disciplined Investor is the first book I wrote. I wrote two. The Disciplined Investor is actually still available on Audible. You can go over to audible.com, which is owned by Amazon these days. But you can go over to audible.com, search for my name, Andrew Horowitz, or write The Disciplined Investor. And the audiobook is available there. And I think I actually read the book for the audiobook. That's what they wanted me to do. And you'll get some good pieces of information there. And I think if you're looking for an education about, for example, options, we have a section on options there. If you want to look at, for example, what is fundamental analysis, understand about technical analysis, there are sections in there. So this is a kind of a real quick, I guess, overview of investing, especially if you're a little bit newer into the markets and you want just a course of the big, broad picture of all sorts of market instruments and how they operate, as well as styles of analysis. That's what that's for. Go over to audible.com and look up my name, look up The Disciplined Investor, and download it and listen to it. Thank you. And if you want also, I'll just mention one last time, if you want to ask me a question, go over to disciplinedinvestor.com and click on Ask Andrew, and we'll get you squared away as best as possible. Moving along, I think it would be remiss if we didn't have a few minutes talking about Twitter. Now, there's been a lot of speculation over the last several months as Jack Dorsey came back and tried to fix Twitter's problems, you know, adding the NFL and changing the way that the tweet would be displayed and adding the memories. And then also, of course, we know that there is a live version of tweets, of videos that you can use right now with Periscope and a variety of the other things that Twitter has done, trying to, number one, stop the hemorrhaging of advertisers leaving, adding to the user base and attracting more people in the face of a lot of competition with Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram and all the different things that are out there. And the speculation over the last several months has been that there would be a potential suitor. But the price of Twitter, with the facts that still haven't been solved of declining users and their ad revenue slowing down, and even with this new NFL deal, and well, anyway, so there's a lot of potential conversations that have been going on about, oh, well, somebody's going to buy them because the price is down so low. That seems to be a common theme, especially with all the money that is held on the books by many of these technology companies. They could pretty much do a lot with all cash deals. So David Faber from CNBC reported on Friday that there was some definite and definitive discussions with several companies. Google was one of the companies that was named, and there was a few others. Salesforce was a company. I don't really understand the fit with Salesforce necessarily, except for the fact that they really tried to get LinkedIn, and they tried to buy that, and Microsoft stole it from them, or at least outbid them. And maybe they were looking for another technology deal to somehow, you know, enhance their income flow and maybe even strap on to their current product, which, again, I don't really see the relationship. Interestingly, Salesforce was down about 5% on this news. I guess that would not be a welcome deal to do for Salesforce with respect to at least how the investing, the market and the investors feel about that. So Google comes up as one of the ones that would be very much a good fit because of the current offerings that Google has, and particularly when you think about the Google Plus that they have. I don't know. I mean, Twitter had one of its best days on record, if not the best day, up 20, almost 21% on the session Friday. There's a lot of shorts that are involved in Twitter. I'll tell you right now, and thinking that the company was just going to continue its current process and as a standalone, and Jack Dorsey was not going to find anybody else to come in and help out or take over as CEO. And where we are now is that the speculation is running rampant. I am very skeptical about some of this, questioning what the price would be paid would be. But obviously there was a leak of this information, or at least a desire to get it out there to see what would be the reaction by investors. And whoever the party is that put out this piece and brought the information to David Faber obviously was desirous of seeing how the stock would react in such a situation. But again, you know, there's a big question mark on this. It is very possible that Twitter would be sold. It's also possible that we may see a take under rather than take over if the conditions are still that Twitter is in a declining overall corporate environment. It would seem that maybe they'd buy it for a lot less, or at least put the offer in at a lot less. Nobody wants to overpay for it because Twitter is still kind of a relatively rich valued company when you consider all things that they have. The NFL offering, interesting, possibly something that Apple would want to pick up and integrate. That's an interesting play. But again, it's a bit thin. Google would, you know, they have enough cash to pick it up very easily. That wouldn't be a problem. Integration would be somewhat easy. Some people are talking about things like Walt Disney or maybe even like a crazy like a GE. Some of these things are a little bit on the outskirts possible, but yet maybe Jack Dorsey is just tired of the whole deal and wants to hand it over and cash out of it and you know, kind of see how this can work under a different management structure. I don't know. If you have any thoughts on it, I'd be interested to hear it. You could tweet me on it, which would be interesting. Tweet me over at Andrew Horowitz on Twitter. That's going to wrap it up. A little bit of a shortened show this week. I've been traveling a little bit, just in from Michigan from a couple days over there for a family event, and I'm a little bit exhausted. I'll be honest with you. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week with some other great information on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.